This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium.
You're listening to Radio Kidnappers, the voice of Hawke's Bay, and I'm Lynn Trafford, presenting on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand, Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. This program is your opportunity to get to know practicing and recently retired scientists from around the bay. With me in the studio, I have Dr. Jeffrey Smith, known to associates, friends and family as Jeff. Dr. Smith is the team leader, principal scientist in hydrology and hydrogeology in the resource management group at the Hawke's Bay Regional Council in Napier. With degrees from Otago and Waikato universities, today we will learn how this hunting, surfing, scuba diving, music-loving scientist ended up living and working in Hawke's Bay. We welcome Dr. Jeff Smith to Radio Kidnappers and Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air.
Kia ora.
It's lovely to have you with us today. Now, I understand that you're not really a Hawke's Bay boy. Whereabouts are you from, Jeff?
I'm from the west coast of the South Island. I grew up just south of Greymouth.
Did you go to school down there or did you get sent away?
No, I went to school at Greymouth High School.
Greymouth High School. Was there a time when you were at high school, Jeff, when you decided that maybe science was going to be your career, or was it always going to be that you would be an electrician?
I had no idea what I wanted to do at school, so I became an electrician largely by default, I guess.
By default. It happens to lots of people, I think, along the line, while you sort out what you really want to do with your life. So you did the full-on apprenticeship?
I did, yeah.
Trade certificate? Yeah. So 4 years or something?
I think so, yeah. I was on the New Zealand Railways for 5 years in total.
And when you finished that, you skived off overseas for a wee period of time?
I actually went to university for 2 years and then skived off. I was part of the restructuring in the late 80s. There was a lot of redundancies and what have you, and I had no idea what I wanted to do still. I thought I'd go to university and study business.
Oh, study business.
Yeah, and my first year at university changed that, decided I wasn't into that at all.
All right, so you go away overseas. When you came back, you'd obviously got your head sussed out.
Yeah, I was in the UK, and it was during the recession of early 90s. I expected to go over there based on what other people had said, with, you know, heaps of jobs for electricians, and there just wasn't. I noticed there were a lot of jobs for professional people, and I just remembered back to university what I'd enjoyed about it and decided I'd bring the family back and do that.
Okay. So back down south, did you do your first degree down south at Otago?
I did, yeah. I majored in geography with hydrology as the specialty.
And so how long were you down there? Did you do a master's down there as well?
Or did you I did a BSc honours as a fast track to a PhD. If you get first-class honours, you can go straight in.
But you didn't do your PhD down there, did you?
No, I became really interested in another graduate of Otago University, Dr. Dave Campbell, who was at that time and still is at the University of Waikato. Became really interested in the research that he was doing and decided I wanted to pursue a PhD.
What was he doing?
Wetland hydrology is his specialty.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you come north and you manage to get some money from Landcare Research to help you through your PhD. Is that how it worked?
That's right, yeah. They offered a scholarship of sorts, or should I say research funding. Yeah.
Okay, so what were you studying?
So the PhD was an investigation of wetland hydrology and plant physiological processes. It was all about the peat accumulation process and how the water table and the plant physiology works with that. And at the time, it sort of didn't fit into hydrology, didn't fit into ecology. It wasn't really a discipline that defined what I was doing, but now it's known as ecohydrology.
There's a lot of peat around there for you to study, isn't there, around the Waikato?
There is a lot of peat. There's not a lot of undeveloped peat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So where did you have to go to do that?
There's a small remnant wetland near the airport called Moana Tuatua.
Oh, okay. Mm. Yeah, I can visualise the airport, but I can't visualise what it is that you're talking about. So you spent 5 years thereabouts studying this particular piece, did you?
It was about 4 years.
What did you learn during that time?
In a nutshell, it was that the conventional wisdom is that if you drain a wetland, you'll lose all the peat because the oxygen gets in, the microbes respire and the peat degrades. We found that that wasn't the case. It's a rectangular-shaped remnant wetland that's been drained at the perimeter, so the water table has dropped, and we found it was a strong sink for carbon, which means it's either accumulating peat or some other carbon sink.
And I know we're going to leap very much into the future, which I don't really want to do, but over time, have you been able to apply what you learned during your PhD in any way to the future jobs that you've had since you left university?
Oh, absolutely. It's not so much about the subject that I was on at the time. It's the, I call it transferable skills, I guess, the ability to process large amounts of data, analyse it and interpret the results. It's quite generic across science.
Yeah. So it was a good period of time for you?
Oh, absolutely. Loved it.
You loved it. And did you like being based in Hamilton?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we lived in Raglan for a period of time.
Very nice for the surfing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then moved to Hamilton after I'd nearly finished my PhD. And then I was there for a few years after that.
Right. The first real science job, I suppose, we're talking about here, was with the Waikato Regional Council. So what sorts of things were you doing with them, Jeff, right back in the early days?
Yeah, so that was exactly the time when the National Environmental Standard for Air Quality came out, and there was a lack of air quality scientists in New Zealand, per se. So because I'd used a gas analyzer for my PhD, and as I said about those transferable skills, there was a job in air quality that came up that I thought sounded quite exciting. Wasn't hydrology, but no, it was science nonetheless.
Yeah. It's really funny when you spend all that time studying one aspect and then you move across to another. But you're quite right about the air quality, and we definitely need a lot of work still in that particular area, don't we? It stood you in good stead, though, because it was the basis on which you could build a few more years of practical science.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the regional council experience was invaluable.
Yes.
I particularly like working at regional councils because of the applied nature of the science.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're with lots of other chaps and chapsesses who are also equally as passionate about science as you are.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find that across New Zealand, isn't it? There's a whole bunch of scientists in a regional council, but not in a city council, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's a good place for you to be. You went to Niwa?
Yeah.
Whereabouts were you? Were you still in Hamilton with them, or did they move you somewhere else?
No, we moved the family down to Christchurch. There was the opportunity.
Back down south.
Yeah, there was the opportunity to stay on the North Island, but for personal reasons, we wanted to get back to the South Island at the time.
So what were you doing with Niwa?
Air quality science and a little bit of hydrology.
What were you studying? What were you looking at?
It wasn't so much large projects at the time. It was more offering commercial support to regional councils and what have you. There was FORCED at the time, the central government funded research for looking at the effects of wood burners and other emissions on air quality.
Across New Zealand as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, but it also put you in touch with all the scientists at Environment Canterbury, didn't it? So that was a good thing for you to do. So you ended up working there.
Yeah, I got a job as a full-time hydrologist, which was
that must have been joyous.
Oh, the dream job, yeah.
Here we go, we're starting the right career in about, 2008?
Yeah.
After all this time, we've finally got it sussed and you can spend 5 years playing around with water stuff. What were you doing down there for Environment Canterbury? Because it covers a big area, Environment Canterbury, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and hence they have a lot of scientists, so it was divided up into surface water, hydrology and groundwater, which kind of worked somewhat autonomously. I was in the surface water section. There was a lot of work, and there still is, in regional plan development for water allocation down there. So I was there for about 5 years and involved in two of those regional plans.
All right. So these are plans specifically for two of the rivers down there, were they? Is that what the plans were for?
The first one was the Hurunui Waio. Yes. Waio Rivers in North Canterbury, and then the second one was the South Canterbury coastal streams, so from one end of the region to the other.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Now, what you were learning down there, you were also able to extend personal skills as well, weren't you? Because you did a lot of iwi liaison, technical advice and recommendations, so people skills as well as the writing and the data analysis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Suit your personality, that?
In some ways it's challenging for a scientist, especially when you're doing a PhD. Like, I was literally locked myself in a downstairs office for a couple of years to get that done, so I was working on my own. But I really, really enjoy working with stakeholders and seeing the applied nature of the science.
It makes it all worthwhile, doesn't it, somehow? You've got all that theory and you know you can actually put it to very good use. That kind of work that you were doing with Environment Canterbury backed on to, or gave you a good foundation, I suppose, for coming back to Waikato again, bit of a tiger for punishment, I think, and working with them as a senior scientist. So what were you doing this time round with Waikato Regional Council, and how did what you learned in Canterbury be able to be used in the Waikato, or were they two standalone?
No, definitely complementary. The attraction of going to Waikato is a one-year contract for a good friend of mine and colleague that I did my PhD with, who is a hydrologist at Waikato Regional Council, was on a sabbatical for 12 months.
Oh, okay.
So I took his role, and the reason it was so attractive is because it was about plan implementation. They'd already gone through and had a water allocation plan that was operative, so there was the opportunity to work on implementation, but also it was combined surface water and groundwater.
So working on a plan that's already done, was that better? I mean, in my head, that would be more exciting, but maybe not for a scientist?
It comes with its own challenges. There's a whole lot of new rules that are in place that are being tested in the real world, if you like.
Uh-huh.
So it's not better or worse, it's just different.
Just different. Yeah. Were you dealing with farmers with this, or who were you mostly dealing with?
Yeah, there's a lot of dairy farmers in the Waikato,
there
obviously.
Are, yeah.
There was a lot of consent applications for dairy shed washdown water, which in the plan required a consent application for those, whereas previously they didn't have one. So there was a lot of those that had to be pushed through in a short amount of time. Applications for large water takes. And as I said, the rules were being tested at the time, so it was a lot of the stuff hadn't really been applied in the consenting environment.
Did you find yourself, therefore, being some sort of technical advice type person?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, so in a technical advice role, were you dealing with the same people, or were there other aspects of business and agriculture across Waikato that you found yourself getting involved in?
That was mostly the dairy industry,
and
it was also working really closely with the resource use directorate at Waikato, who, as I said, they are the ones that are issuing the consents and going to hearings and what have you as the rules were being applied.
You had another short contract round about that time as well. Once again, water research science, contract services and hydrology. But, more to the point, you ended up here in Hawke's Bay at the beginning of 2016. What happened and how did you get here, Jeff?
Well, my contract at Waikato was due to expire. I had another contract with Environment Canterbury. There was work on the horizon, but this job was advertised, and my co-pilot in life noticed that it advertised and suggested I have a look at it. And the more I looked at it, the more attracted I was to it. We spent a weekend in Napier, loved the place. So going through that job application process, I was very mindful that it had to be a job that worked for me, and asked a lot of questions. And the more I asked, the more I was attracted to it.
Okay, so what is the job that you actually applied for?
So it's a team leader role. There's five scientists in my team.
So what is your, what is your team? What is your title? You are the team leader, principal scientist.
Hydrology and hydrogeology.
Right, hydrology and hydrogeology.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're in resource management. You have,
Five scientists who do both surface water and groundwater investigations. And at the moment there's a massive project to model the groundwater flow and surface water interaction for the Hiratonga Plains.
And let's just define for our listeners the region that you and your team actually are working in. Where does your extent of coverage go across Hawke's Bay?
Oh, so this is a plan change for the Tutaikuri, Ahureri, Ngaruroro and Karamu rivers and streams.
Okay.
So it's four very large catchments.
Yes.
Includes Napier, Hastings, Havelock North. And the focus of the model is on the plains area from the foothills out to the sea.
Can we, while we're defining, just get all this out the way so that then we can talk and everyone understands what we're talking about? There's been a lot of publicity and discussion recently about the aquifers that feed us in some way or another. What is an aquifer and where do we find such animals?
So an aquifer is a geological formation that has saturated material that's sufficient to yield significant amounts of water to.
Now, Jeff, that all sounds very gobbledygook. What actually does all this really mean? A big puddle of water somewhere?
What it means is under the land surface on the Hiratonga Plains, there's a whole lot of gravel that was deposited by the rivers that were fanning out over a long period of time. And over top of those, you have finer sediments that were deposited by marine environments as the sea transgressed and then withdrew again. And those fine sediments confine the gravels below it, where those fine sediments exist. So the gravels contain water that is extractable in economic quantities. And also supplies water to springs, so it feeds the in-stream values for surface waters as well.
So these sands and gravels are like a great big filter?
Yeah.
A collection point for this water?
A filter and a store.
Where does it mostly come from, this water?
It comes entirely, almost entirely from rain falling on the hills, and then it dives into the aquifers. It also the rain that falls on the unconfined areas of the aquifer will infiltrate into the aquifers and recharge them as well, and it ends up either being abstracted, flowing to surface waters or out to sea.
Okay, right. Now your five scientists, are all five working studying this particular aquifer or just some of the five of you?
No, there's other business as usual tasks that are still going on, but it is the big focus for our team at the moment.
So what are they looking for, Jeff?
What we're wanting to do is inform a large stakeholder group who have to make decisions, recommendations for water allocation. So the model will be used to test allocation scenarios and predict the effects of those.
So modelling something like this cannot be cheap.
It's not cheap, and it's technically very challenging as well.
Is it?
It's a very impressive model, as I said. It's one of the reasons I was really attracted to coming here. And in some ways it's ambitious, but it's also achievable.
What are the technical challenges then that you're facing with this?
It's just such a complex environment that we're trying to model. Any model is a simplification of reality, so we're trying to get as much reality into the model as possible without compromising it. One of the big challenges is the computational resources that are required to run a model of this complexity. So we're using NIWA's supercomputer or GNS's supercomputer to do calibration runs because it just takes too long to run on a regular computer.
Is that a capacity thing, really?
Yeah.
Yes, capacity.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of data being fed into it then. If there you're using a supercomputer, you can't be using it because you've only got hardly any data.
Yeah, there is a lot of data, and it depends on how you discretize the area that you're modeling as well. At Canterbury, the models were typically about 500, discretized into 500 square meter grids, and you run calculations for each of those grid cells. Here we're doing 100 by 100 meter grid cells, so it's a really high resolution model.
Yeah.
And it's like 25 times finer than the models we were doing at Canterbury.
So you're able to do the analysis at that size grid simply because you've got this big computer? Is that how it's working?
Kind of. It's the other way around. We've got this big computer because we chose to have such a fine grid, and we were looking for solutions to implement that.
Great. It's really good, isn't it?
Oh, it's exciting.
Yes, it is. It is. The water from this aquifer, are you studying the uses of the water coming out the other end of it, or are you just studying how it gets in there and what happens to it while it's in there?
We have to investigate how it gets in there. They run off from the hills and recharge our inputs to the model. Outputs to the model are flow from surface waters out to sea and through the aquifer directly to the sea. And it's what goes on within the model domain that's really interesting us.
So what is going on?
Some water's abstracted. Water's also discharged from the groundwater via springs and groundwater seepage into the surface waters. So it's not just about groundwater. It's integrated with the surface water as well to not only forecast what water could be abstracted for out-of-stream uses, but also what would be the in-stream effects on the surface waterways from abstracting more or less water.
Are you at such a stage with your modelling that you're getting some conclusions to these questions, or is it still at a stage where the data is just being fed in? Where are we at?
The model at the moment is being calibrated. So what we need to do is build a model that represents what's going on in the real world at a level that we need to understand for the application that we're using it for. We are probably a third of the way through that process. The model will be fully developed at the end of November this year.
Okay.
It is a really complex task. We've got, as I said, the majority of the team's resources are spent on this, and we've also got a lot of external help from consultants and what
so
have you.
So this is no cheap exercise. It's a super-duper scientific exercise, but this is going to be a lot of money spent on it.
It is a big investment by the Regional Council, absolutely. And it's a tool that will be used not just for this plan change. It's a tool that we're wanting to make available for other people to use so they can use it for water management purposes. And also it'll be a tool that will be developed in the future and also available in the future as the situation changes, as water allocation, water use, water demands change. This tool will be available into the future.
So once we've got it right, it becomes a very accessible tool for all sorts of other areas as well.
Absolutely.
That's really good,
isn't
it? Can you tell me, I'm really interested to know, have you any idea if we're getting as much water going into that aquifer these days as we've had in the past? I know you haven't got the data from haven't got data from 50 years ago, 25 years ago, I don't know, I'm just guessing here. But do we know if we've got as much water as we used to have?
There is the same amount of water there. It's like you get variability of recharge through the seasons and what have you, and between years. Also, there is recharge from irrigation as well. Any irrigation that's applied inefficiently can recharge the aquifers. So it's not so much about what's going into the aquifers, though. It's what's being taken out that we're most interested in.
Okay, let's talk about what's coming out. The water that's coming out, some of it you've already said is going to flow straight back into Hawke Bay.
Yeah.
What else is coming out? What are the uses for the other portions of water that's coming out? What do we use it for?
There's a lot for irrigation, also municipal supplies. It's abstracted for town supplies, domestic water use. There's around about 3.5 billion cubic metres of water estimated to be in the aquifer, and about 5% of that's abstracted for human use, which doesn't sound a lot.
So this is your total, by human use, you mean that covers the municipal, the industry, the irrigation, is just 5% of it?
Yeah.
Right, okay. And are we pretty static in that percentage of what we use?
No.
Or does it vary?
It's been increasing over the years. We've got... we're modelling since 1980.
Okay.
Since that
so we
time.
Are going back quite a way then.
Yeah.
Sort of. It's not that far, I guess, in the overall history.
Yeah, in terms of water use it is, there wasn't a lot, relatively much, being abstracted back
then. Is that because we've changed what we are actually farming across Hawke's Bay?
Possibly, yeah, and also the availability and technology for irrigation and just the demand for water across the country. It's not unique to Hawke's Bay, obviously.
Yeah. All right. So you've got about three members of your team heavily engaged in making certain this model is as perfect as it can be.
Yes.
What else are they doing?
The other responsibilities include state of environment reporting.
Yes.
And advice on consenting applications. There's other plan changes in the wings as well. There's the Mohaka plan change that has just started to be on our radar as well, as scientists. It's been on the council's radar for a while, but as scientists we really need to start supporting that. That plan needs to be notified at the end of next year as well.
Uh-huh. Where are we sitting as far as your work is concerned for the future? What is in front of you and your team, Jeff?
Well, once this plan change is notified and even operative, the work doesn't stop then. As I said, we've got other plan changes in the wings, and then we start going into plan implementation. As I said, it's what I was working on at Waikato. That's already underway for the Tuki Tuki, which is now an operative plan, and that comes with its challenges as well. And then there's a policy cycle. After 5 or 10 years, you start to review the plans to make sure that they're still effective, don't need modifying. So as I said, that's when the model will be rolled out again. Possibly improved, new data, new demands. So it's an ongoing policy cycle.
Updated. Good science, though, isn't it? This is very good practical science that you and your team are doing at the council.
Yeah. I think that the policy needs to be science-informed.
Yes.
And the better the science, the better informed the decision-makers can be.
Yeah. Quite right. On behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand and Radio Kidnappers, thank you, Dr. Jeff Smith, for being my guest on Hawke's Bay Scientist on Air. Great to have you. To find out more about hydrology or air quality sciences in New Zealand or the roles our scientists play at Hawke's Bay Regional Council, the best place to start is a Google search. Similarly, to find out more about the Royal Society in New Zealand or in the Bay, start by visiting our websites. Please join me on Monday mornings at 9:30 to meet another practicing or recently retired Hawke's Bay scientist. I'm Lynn Trafford.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.